formation. He's going for the corner. He's got it. Texas is back. The kicker comes through.
We're back. Welcome to a new episode of Fire Todd Orlando, your definitely not overreactionary and totally reasonable Texas football fan podcast. I am your host, Josh, and today is a big throwback episode because we got the gang back together. Former host and now producer slash editor Tux is here to co-host this episode with me. How you doing, man?
Oh, I am here, man. I am excited. I'm so happy because you know what? We've been talking about firing people for like the past 2.5 years, and we might actually be on the verge of something like that.
Yeah, I mean, we could finally meme someone into oblivion. It's not the person I've been trying since the start of this podcast.
You've been trying hard.
I have not put down that pitchfork. We have been pushing as much as we possibly can, and it is just not happening.
But I feel like Wareheim, and you know, we're not getting TH, but if we're getting a coordinator level firing, that's still a win in my book.
Yeah, I mean, that it definitely accomplishes what we've been looking to do with this podcast. And unfortunately, if you're a poster over at our Longhorn Nation, the deal for getting rid of Brewbot from Longhorn Mod is Derek Wareheim getting fired. So it's really gonna ring hollow. Like, yeah, we'll have memed someone into getting fired, but at what cost, really?
Well, I mean, any firing is good, so I don't think there's any downside to this. There's no cost to this.
All fires provide warmth, and that's what we're about.
That is a great phrase. All fires provide warmth, guys.
That could probably be said more eloquently. I'll have to rewrite that in my head for a tweet or something. But let's start talking exactly about why we're firing Todd Orlando, because anyone who did not drink themselves into a blackout before like the third offensive drive for Texas on Saturday, it's going to be pretty obvious why we're firing him.
Yeah, and you know, before we really begin breaking down Orlando, we do have to add some context to this, right? Like, we do have to talk about how we have something like 6 defensive backs hurt. We have all these linebacker injuries, and then we've had some other guys that have missed time, like Roach, due to a suspension and all this stuff. So there's a lot going on, right? And I'm not trying to excuse this and say that we should not be firing Todd Orlando. I'm not doing that at all. I'm just adding context that, A, we have so many guys missing time. B, a lot of these guys that are playing, they were already replacing 8 starters from last year, right? And then now we're having to replace those guys mid-season, so we're playing a ton of third-stringers, fourth-stringers. And I saw something on, Anwar Richardson said it, at some point in the game against Kansas late, Texas was so depleted at safety, they were playing a walk-on. And they had to call a timeout because that walk-on somehow got matched up against Parchment was Kansas's wide receiver, and
yep.
They were like, nope, just call this timeout. Let's run this back, guys.
Yeah, this is a problem. When you're starting the, I think it was Mason Ramirez, who, if I'm not mistaken, is the guy who was playing safety, and then because of the injuries in fall camp, got moved to running back. And then I believe he was also the one who went to the hospital due to heat exhaustion. So then got somehow moved back to safety, but was matched up in man against Kansas's best receiver. So there's a lot of moving parts to this sort of shit show that's going on that side of the ball.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to blame Mason Ramirez for this. He was put in an unfortunate spot. But with all this context added, we're still seeing some absolutely terrible play, man. These defenders don't know where to be. These defenders have no idea how to tackle. I think Texas is last in the country, or I guess tops, depending on how you view it, in the most amount of missed tackles. And then outside of all that, they have just no idea what scheme they're running or what they're supposed to do.
If it wasn't for all these problems, I'd actually be kind of excited to throw out that it's nice for us to be playing a white walk-on safety only because we have unprecedented attrition due to injury in the defensive backfield and are not playing him by choice because he's the best guy we've got.
Yeah, basically. I don't doubt that Mason is a perfectly fine person, but he should not be on that field right now. I mean,
yeah, if he's we're a walk-on for a reason.
Yeah, if we're up by 40 or something, I don't care, man. Play him. Give them some time. He's contributed to the program by being a great player and all that stuff. But if you're in a tight conference game, never mind the opponent, and you're having to play a walk-on defensive back in this conference, I'm sorry, but you are deeply and truly fucked.
Yeah. If you had told me pre-game that Mason Ramirez was going to get on the field in the fourth quarter against Kansas, I would have thought it was because we were up by 5 scores on him late.
Exactly.
But yeah, I mean, this was a tough game. I mean, you want to like try and find some sort of bright spot to point to for this defense. And I mean, outside of maybe some sporadic play, I thought from Byron Vaughns for being really his first legitimate snaps at linebacker, I thought he did okay. Wasn't amazing. He looks like a redshirt freshman, and that's okay because that's where he's supposed to be. But he's not supposed to be in that situation without all this sort of upperclassman experience support around him, which is how a healthy defense would be bringing in younger guys.
You know, I thought another couple bright spots was actually DeMarvion Overshown being inserted at safety after a few weeks where he was recovering from a back injury. He looked fine. You know, in a perfect world, he's our third or fourth safety coming off the bench. Or sorry, not, I wouldn't say off the bench, but he's our third or fourth safety overall. And that's, he's perfect for that. He's still young. He can develop. And pressed into time, I thought he looked fine. And the other one, who again keeps putting in great performances that get wasted, is Keandre Coburn. Teams have now just realized that, you know, we are not going to win against Keandre Coburn, but we can have wins everywhere else on the field. We just have to not go to Keandre Coburn. And it doesn't matter what that poor guy does, he just doesn't get the credit, and it looks like, oh, the Texas defensive line is terrible. But in reality, he's never going to get the credit because of how terrible the defense is around him.
Yeah, if we could even just get sort of average to below average play from every other position, that would force a lot more plays to go into Keandre Coburn's sort of wingspan. And I think we'd be talking a lot more about him, not just for us specifically, but on a Big 12 level, being all Big 12 defensive lineman of the year in sort of the same realm as Puna Ford and Charles Omenihue the last 2 years. Might be getting more recognition on the national level for being disruptive in the middle there. But yeah, I mean, there's just so many things not working for this defense. Not getting any pass rush from the defensive ends. Our best pass rusher is a B-backer in Joseph Osai. But just because of his athleticism and because of the holes we have everywhere else, he barely gets any time to pass rush because he needs to cover up all of the deficiencies everywhere else on the field.
Yeah, and I described this a little bit earlier. We are stuck between a ton of no-win situations, right? The first thing is all these defensive backs, we're blitzing them. Why? Well, we're getting no pressure from our traditional set. And while, you know, that's okay every once in a while, we're having to do it a ton because there's no way, no other way that we're getting pressure. But that's leaving our other defenders on an island. And so we're having to drop them back. But then that, even that doesn't work because a lot of guys do not know where to be. So even when you have them drop back, there's still issues, there's still mistakes happening, and there's still guys blowing past the coverages. So it's just, it's maddening watching this. And Joseph Osai is also probably getting wasted as a result. Just like you said, he's our best linebacker, he's our best rusher, but we need him to patrol the middle, basically. And I just feel so bad for a lot of these guys because we can clearly see there's talent. We can clearly see that if they were used more effectively, or if just a couple other things were shored up, like our outside linebacker play or our defensive end play, it would allow everything else to really kind of slide into a complete picture. But we're not seeing it.
Yeah, and with those defensive backs, with busted coverages, to make it even more maddening, it's not uncommon for them to be in the correct spot but it is extremely uncommon when they are in the correct spot for them to get their head around to actually make a play on the ball. So it seems like we can get good coverage sometimes and not do anything with it because we forgot to, like, see where to put our hand to knock the ball down, to intercept the ball. So the end result of all this is you have guys like Carter Stanley, who, let's be honest, I don't care if you just switch to an offensive coordinator with some balls at Kansas, has no business throwing for more than 300 yards on us and looking practically like an All-American against his defense, making throws and completions that you should not be making given the windows that you're throwing into sometimes. I mean, we gave him quite a few open looks. I mean, several just wide open touchdowns. And then there were just completely ridiculous catches that were basically only contested no more than sort of having a traffic cone in the way might be contesting the catch. And that, yeah, we're there, but we're not getting our hands in the way and we're not getting our head around to make a play on the ball to shut down the play and the throw that's being made.
Yeah, the classic example I keep thinking of is that far right sideline catch late in the fourth quarter where I think the guy caught it against his wrist or something. And it's like, what? How did that even come about? But then you see the play and you see that the defensive back, I think it was Jameson, but I may be wrong, never really turned around to make a play on the ball. So really, it's not like he was in coverage there at all. And just, it's maddening, right? And to add on to all of this shit show, like we mentioned beforehand, nobody's making tackles. Puka Williams should not have had 200 yards. If Texas just gets him down, make sure that he doesn't pick up yards after contact, this game is very different.
Yeah, it's an extremely worrying development. I think we all sort of knew and accepted, especially after that LSU game, that the pass defense was going to be pretty suspect. But Puka Williams going absolutely wild on our defense is alarming after we were all excited about our run defense being legitimately good in the wake of that Oklahoma State game where we all but shut down Chuba Hubbard because it took him, 40 snaps, to 40 touches to get to 100 yards rushing against us or something like that?
Yeah.
And then you have this where I don't think he broke out of the teens to get to 200.
He had 100 yards by the end of the first quarter or just like a couple of minutes into the second quarter. That should not be happening to you against, I mean, let's be honest here. He still plays for Kansas. There's no way he should be this productive against us. But our edge run defense is so terrible. Guys do not realize, especially BJ Foster, that you have a guy in Keandre Coburn who can make all this magic happen. Just funnel runners away from you and into Coburn. That's it. That's all you need to do. Set the edge. And nobody knows how to do it because everybody's looking to get into the backfield immediately and make a big play, and it's being used against us.
Yeah, and that's the danger with those exotic blitzes that Todd Orlando brings. A lot of those aren't designed to be sort of run blitzes. We're not looking to shut down the run. We're not looking to fill gaps by blitzing. We're just looking to get after the quarterback. So everyone, for all the good things that we get out of pass rushing with B.J. Foster and DeMarvion Overshown, that all can be exploited really easily when you know that those guys are going to be the ones rushing and you know they're going to get tunnel vision and just get locked onto that quarterback and not be able to process the rest of the play around them. It's, again, yeah, you're getting guys in the backfield, you're getting guys who can be disruptive, have the athleticism to be disruptive, can be in the right place, but are so spun up on getting to the quarterback that they can't see what else is going on.
No, and that kind of leads me to bring up a bigger point. This is the third straight year now, right, that Texas has come out looking absolutely terrible on defense. And at what point do you just go, well, screw it. If we just cannot get this going immediately, then what is the point? Like, the first year, that was a great defense, but it took them the Maryland loss to regroup, come together, figure out what they wanted to do, and then Todd Orlando stole some stuff from Iowa State, and then that's when we had an elite defense, right? And then last year, started off great, and then all of a sudden, all these tackling issues, all these issues with setting the edge, all these issues in coverage are just blown wide open, and then for three or four games last year, Texas had no idea what to do. And then again, they had to regroup, and then after that regrouping effort, you know, they turned in some decent performances towards the end of last year, starting with Iowa State. And then now, we're looking at potentially the worst defense in Texas history. And I keep waiting for that, okay, here's the regrouping moment. I thought it would be after OU or maybe after LSU, but we still keep waiting and it hasn't happened yet. You know, even if it does happen, there's no way we can justify keeping Todd Orlando if this just happens all the time now.
Yeah, it's a pattern that we can't repeat, especially with next year when the assumption is that Sam Ellinger will be back. He's going to stay around for his senior year because this dude bleeds burnt orange more than anyone else on the planet. You're talking about having a senior Sam Ellinger. You're going to have an upperclassman running back. You're going to have a crazy running back recruiting class. Just in Bijan Robinson alone, never mind getting Jordan Whittington for a full season. You're going to have an experienced Jake Smith. You're going to have guys on the outside and Brennan Eagles who have gotten experience. And you're going to have, assuming Cosme sticks around based on how these last few games have gone, you're going to have a pretty strong upperclassman-heavy line yet again for the offensive line. So you've got sort of everything loaded for bear, really, on the offensive side where you're ready to take that next step going into next season. But with that much uncertainty on defense, if you're going to have Todd Orlando stick around where it's proven to just get worse and worse and worse, and you're going to have these dips where the things aren't coming together right away and they sort of need to regroup every few games, you're going to end up blowing your best shot since Mack Brown left, and even before then, since 2009. This would be the best shot that we've had at a national title in more than 10 years. And if we don't move on from Todd Orlando and don't find an adequate replacement, whether that's in the form of a Chris Ash or someone else, I don't know. I haven't really dug in that far to who the replacement needs to be based on our personnel, based on backgrounds. But you're looking at pinning your hopes for a honest-to-God shot at the college football playoff on Todd Orlando refiguring out how to coach defense, which he has not been able to do for what will have been 2 years of just constantly getting worse.
Yeah, and there's another factor to consider. Todd Orlando has become extremely predictable with his blitzes, his coverages, everything else. And I understand that this is the part where context plays, with all these injuries and inexperience, he really can't, I guess, switch it up too much. But still, what we do run, we're not good at, you know, at all. And then the last point I wanted to make is there's fundamentals missing. And I do wonder, at what point do you start to almost blame Tom Herman for this? Because he has said that in his first year, he blamed the early Maryland loss to practices that were too physical, and it kind of shocked him into more soft tackling practices and all this stuff. Well, last year he did the same thing where he didn't have the physical practices. He just kept the soft tackling, and it bit him again. And then he had to introduce the live tackling drills, and then the defense improved. And this year he said the same exact stuff after the OU loss. And, oh, we need to go back to live tackling. We've been doing too many soft tackles. I want to blame Todd Orlando. There's plenty of blame to go around. But we also kind of have to deflect a little bit at Herman and say, hey, you are ultimately in charge, and this has been a consistent issue now for the third straight year. You, in your fifth year as a head coach, have not figured out the right practice balance, the right coaching balance, right? Because there's 7 offensive coaches to 4 defensive coaches. It doesn't make any sense. Ultimately, we do have to assign some of this blame to Herman.
Yeah, especially if it would be one thing if it was just the youth, if it was just, even if it was just something as serious as the scheme, because obviously with Herman being offensively minded, he's not going to have a lot of say in what the scheme is for the defense. He's going to have to count on Orlando to execute that. When we're lacking in those fundamentals of being able to set the edge, being able to make tackles, being able to get your head around when in coverage on a guy who's clearly trying to catch the ball, when it's those little fundamental things, and it's not just one unit that's displaying the problem consistently, that means it's a whole defense-wide issue, then that's something where you got to look at the head coach and say, why are we not spending enough time on fundamentals when they are so glaringly bad? If it was just the defense or just the defensive ends, or if it was just the linebackers, you go, okay, it is this position coach specifically, but it is every single level of this defense struggles to tackle, can't get penetration in the backfield, can't set the edge, whether it's a linebacker, whether it's a defensive end, whether it's a defensive back crashing in. We're not able to set any of the not able to set the edge, not able to make the tackles when we do get guys behind the line of scrimmage. I lost count of how many times we had Puka Williams dead to rights in the backfield last week, and he still managed to gain yards, sometimes in excess of a first down in those situations. When it's that, every single level of the defense is having that struggle, it is entirely a head coach issue for not putting enough emphasis on just simply getting fundamentals right and then worrying about the intricacies of the scheme at a later date.
Yeah, exactly. And I wanted to bring up one final point. This play made me so incredibly upset that I was just like seething about it, right? And we were talking about it as the game was going on too. You know, as soon as Texas went up 47-40 and Kansas got the ball, you sent out a message that, like, you know, Kansas is going to score and they're going to get the 2-point conversion because of course. And it just felt inevitable, right? And the play that I'm talking about is, okay, you know what? There were a lot of bad plays by the Texas defense that allowed Kansas to score, but the most egregiously bad moment was the Kansas 2-point conversion. And I know that it's been beaten to death on Longhorn Internet, but it still bears repeating, right? We had, what, 8 defenders against 4 receivers, right? And there was a guy wide open, 5 yards, nobody around him, inside the end zone from the 3-yard line. Just how do you allow that? And it's not like, that's like their 4th best receiver or something and nobody forgot to cover him. You know, the math says you should have had, you know, if you're defending with 8 people and then say, okay, fine, one of them is a quarterback spy, then that still means you have 7, covering 4 receivers. There's no way anybody should be free. And even then, that guy was, I believe, Stanley's 1st or 2nd read because he looked to the left first. So I can't tell which read he was supposed to do, but it was just so open, so easy for him that I don't know how we can live with that. Of course, everybody's seen the CD Lamb play where he was surrounded by 5 defenders and he still broke free. That's terrible. But, you know, you can say, oh, okay, nobody can tackle. That's something we can work on. But when all these defenders do not know who to cover, where to be, or anything fundamental like that, I just don't know where you begin. I don't know where you begin to start fixing stuff.
Yeah, I think it was sometime in Charlie Strong's last season. I can't remember if it was on BC Unplugged or if it was on 4th and 5 or which podcast or which insider it was talking about it. But I remember someone talking about the issues with Charlie Strong's defense were that you were playing whack-a-mole. One game it would seem like it was a tackling issue. The next game it's a pass rush issue. The next game it's a coverage issue. The next game it's a full-on scheme issue. And that bled over into the special teams. You'd have all these problems that would pop up, and just as soon as you thought you had one covered, you have another one pop up, or one or two or three other issues that pop up, that you're playing whack-a-mole with these issues, and that's the sign of bad coaching. And that's sort of the opinion I have to take with Todd Orlando. It's not one thing. It's not an inability to explain the scheme. It's an inability to explain the scheme, an inability to get a pass rush, an inability to do the fundamentals. And then anytime anything gets fixed up, you have some other issue pop up. You have, okay, someone got hurt, and yet they weren't really performing all that well either. So did we really lose all that much? That was probably the one thing that sort of stuck with me looking back on these games this year, is it's, if it's not one thing, it's another with the Orlando defense this year.
You know what? We're doomed to repeat this cycle since Will Muschamp left, of first-year defensive coordinator. Has a great year. It's fantastic. We talk about, oh, maybe this defensive coordinator might get poached. Insert Utah State, Temple, whatever it is. Second year, Not so good. We think, okay, you know, there's some warning signs. It's okay. It's not a big deal. They'll turn it around because they lost a lot of talent from the first year. And then the third year, everything goes to shit. And we're seeing it again and again and again. And I don't know how we're stuck in this loop with the way we recruit, with the resources that we have, but just it never ends. And yeah, we're going to need a coach who can break the cycle.
Yeah, and it's not even just a defensive coach that can break this cycle. It's this phenomenon, if you want to call it that, has spanned three different head coaches. Obviously, Manny Diaz was the final years with Mack Brown. Then you had Charlie Strong with Vance Bedford. And now you've got Todd Orlando with Tom Herman. So you would think when you have three different head coaches take a shot at not having this issue occur, that you would have three different approaches, and one of them would at least be more effective than the others. And I guess for that, you fall back on Mack Brown, where really the approach was, well, we're going to have an analyst who, if I need to fire this guy after the Mormons run for 3 trillion yards on us, all while wearing knee braces, it'll be an easy, quick fix. I'll have this guy through all of fall practice as a defensive analyst, and we just slot him in and we move on to the next week. That was the closest we've come to a solution. Is just, well, we'll have someone sort of stowed away in case we need to make a quick swap. Otherwise, we're kind of flying by the seat of our pants.
Yeah, basically.
All right, so not to try and pretend like there were some positives, because there were some positives. I mean, obviously the most obvious positive is, I mean, we got ourselves a kicker, for sure. I mean, I talked a little bit a couple weeks ago, I think, just about nerves about Cameron Dicker. And not hitting stuff when he's clutch, but he proved yet again, when you need your field goal kicker to hit field goals, Cameron Dicker's there for you, baby. He got you in the Red River Showdown. He got you bailed out of Kansas losses. I mean, what can't he do?
I love Cameron Dicker. He might be the best player on the team. That's not Sam Ellinger. But that play right before the kick, oh my God, that had me nervous. I think Texas had the ball, 7 seconds left, and they decide to run another play. And I was screaming, what if you have a fumble? What if you, you know, get sacked?
Yeah, bad snap or something.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was risky. I understood what they were going for. I mean, I saw how far Kansas' defensive backs were, so I knew it was going to be a short out, basically, to Devin Duvernay. Just get it to the sideline, pick up a few extra yards. But given the fact that we were already within like the 25 or whatever, it was already a pretty chip shot level field goal for Cameron Dicker. I really don't know that those extra 4 yards that we picked up were at all worth the risk. It wasn't like we were on the edge of whether or not Dicker would make it or not. Us being 4 yards closer, I don't think helped Dicker at all. So while I understood what the thought process was, it was entirely unnecessary and just sort of another bullet point on the list of weird areas where Herman will choose to be aggressive and conservative at seemingly random times. This episode of the Fire Tom Herman podcast on Hornscast is sponsored by Last Stand Hats, the number one place for real Texas fans to get their game day gear. Last Stand Hats gives Texas fans the opportunity to showcase their burnt orange pride by providing apparel options outside the standard block T and Longhorn logos. If you're looking for more variety in your Longhorn gear, you have to check out laststandhats.com. And if you use the code HORNSCAST10 at checkout, you'll save 10% on your order. So make sure to wear your heart on your head and go to laststandhats.com. Hook 'em. The other guy I think that we need to give a shout out to is the sort of usual, Sam Ellinger. He wasn't perfect. He did have the interception. I think one of the worst interceptions he's thrown since Maryland to start last season. But I thought, overall, he had a pretty good game. It's hard to do more than really nitpick when you put up basically 400 yards passing. But the thing I thought was really promising, maybe not given the context of why he had to be doing it, but it seems like the light has sort of come on for Sam as to accepting that the defense is not going to be that supportive for him. So he's sort of getting more accustomed to playing that type of hero ball. And he's done a lot better job, especially in this game, of making those off-schedule runs, really scrambling to pick up the yards rather than needing designed QB runs for him to be able to get that ground yardage.
Yeah, my only real two critiques of the offense, again, these are nitpicks. The first and most important one was that we couldn't isolate the game. Why couldn't we isolate the game? Well, it points to the run game. In the first half, we were kind of running at will. Keontae Ingram was averaging like 10 plus yards a carry, all this stuff. And Kansas made adjustments to this. Kansas knew that if Texas was going to run the read, it was more than likely going to go to the running back. They didn't think that Texas would be running the read option with Sam Ellinger. And so it just allowed them to flow to the running back every time that we pretended like we were going to do a read option play. And because of that, the run game just completely shut down. And in the second half, I think the Texas running backs got 34 yards on 10 carries, and that's just not going to do it. And after that, in the second half, is when Sam had to pick up the pace in terms of running the ball and passing and just moving and doing everything. And it's terrible. My second complaint was that some of those, I don't doubt the decision to go for it on some of those fourth downs early in the game. I just didn't really like the play calls.
That seems to be becoming a thing this year, is really strange play calling, specifically on fourth down. I feel like our general body of play calling this year has been solid to good. It's like on fourth down, we just lose all of our common sense and overcomplicate it. Like every single fourth down is a 2-point conversion.
Yeah, basically. And I guess some context of that is relevant as well, because last year we were, I would say, probably the best fourth down team in the country. We had the most fourth down conversions, most fourth down attempts, and we had the best percentage rate, something like 60-70% on fourth downs, which is amazingly great. And I think we were also like top five in the country in third down rate. And now we're still one of the top teams when it comes to third down conversion. But when it comes to fourth down, we're more like average. And, you know, all of these issues are kind of magnified just because these were such key moments where Texas couldn't convert the ball and Kansas went and scored right afterwards. So it just hurts even more.
All right, and this weekend we are moving on from Kansas to TCU, the last game in this second four-pack, I guess, if you want to call it that, before a bye week in 2 weeks. But before that, like I said, we got TCU. We're playing in Fort Worth. Beat them last year at home, but the last time we were in Fort Worth is still really, if you're going purely by points margin, I believe, still the worst loss of the Tom Herman era at Texas, where I believe we lost, 28-7, 24-7. We did have Shane Buechele as a starting quarterback because Sam was injured his freshman year. It's one of the few places left for Tom Herman to conquer.
Yeah, for sure. You know, outside of the Big 12 Conference Championship game. So yeah, I'm not quite sure what kind of performance we're going to see from the Texas defense, and that worries me a ton.
Yeah, there's a lot of question marks, and I think this bye week's going to come at a good time because a lot of those question marks might be answered by guys coming back from injury. For instance, we got Jalen Green. He's apparently back practicing as of Sunday, but personally, I would be surprised to really see him on the field much against TCU just because I feel like the coaching staff in general feels pretty good about Anthony Cook and Deshaun Jameson, at least enough to say that Jalen Green isn't going to wildly change what we're capable of doing as a defense with when the alternative is Jameson and Cook. So I would be surprised to see him play, give him one more week to rest, give him the bye week, and then be back at hopefully full strength against Kansas State. And I believe that's sort of the same goal we're going with for Caden Stearns. He's outright not going to be available for this TCU game, but it wouldn't surprise me to be on sort of that similar timeline, miss the TCU game, take that bye week to keep healing up, and hopefully be available again for Kansas State.
Yeah, so potentially if everything plays out like we hope it does, you know, after TCU and the bye week, you should get probably a healthier BJ Foster, a healthy Jalen Green, maybe a healthy Caden Stearns, DeMarvion Overshown, who's healed up, and then finally Brandon Jones, who's also healed up. I'm not saying that's going to fix the defense, but it's going to go a pretty long way towards getting to a point where we're maybe respectable.
And on the other side of the ball, we're also going to get some good news, hopefully, Says it's very questionable that he would play this week against TCU, so might as well take that as a he's not playing against TCU. But Jordan Whittington seems to be progressing. We've been saying that now for several weeks, though. So hopefully this is the one where it's, well, if we really, 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 really had to, we could probably play him. But again, take this week off, take the bye week to keep healing up, and then again, add back something positive, or what we assume is something positive, considering we've only seen him for two plays against Louisiana Tech, really. Get Jordan Whittington back against Kansas State and see what that wrinkle does for our offense. See what that threat out of the backfield in the receiving game or even on the ground, what he can offer to this offense to help us keep evolving the offense and not get too stale so a team like Oklahoma can predict exactly what we're going to do.
Yeah, exactly. So with that, do you jump into the TCU offense?
Sure. I mean, obviously at this point it's going to be pretty familiar. We're several years running of Sonny Cumbie being the offensive coordinator at TCU. So those roots are still going to be in that Mike Leach coaching tree with the air raid. But TCU's really struggled really since last year, since Sean Robinson got hurt and elected to transfer. TCU has struggled to find a quarterback. They went through all of spring practice, all of fall practice with a QB competition, and at least as far as Gary Patterson's concerned, he's still got one between freshman Max Duggan and transfer from K-State Alex Delton. But in both of their cases, they're very inconsistent passers, and it's forced TCU to basically be almost a spread option team with the amount that they run the ball.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, Duggan is plenty athletic, so it's not the worst thing. Plus, when you add in a very good running back duo in Alon and Luau and Anderson, you know, you have the ingredients for a very good spread run game. And then, you know, Jalen Reagor for any play action deep shots. That should be the basis of a very good offense. But the light just has not come on for Duggan as a passer. He's incredibly inefficient and inconsistent. So maybe as we go through later through the year, he'll improve. But I think right now, at least, he just is what he is.
Yeah, I would say at this point, it kind of feels like this TCU offense is sort of the C-team knockoff version of Oklahoma. That sort of option-heavy, distribute the ball through the run game a lot, have the quarterback run the ball a lot, like we saw against OU. TCU is very much in that sort of mold right now. They just don't have the level of athlete or the level of experience that Oklahoma has to be able to execute that offense at quite the same high-flying level.
Yeah, but there is one pretty big positive for TCU coming up, and that is that they have to face the Texas defense. I already know that Darius Anderson is going to run for 100-plus yards probably in the first half because he has a very good amount of quickness, burst, has some speed, so they just need to get him moving outside, and he's probably going to pick up chunks and chunks of yards.
To go with Max Duggan, he is a white quarterback, so anyone who's watched Texas football for basically the last, I don't know, 7-8 years, kind of knows to fear anytime they see a white, athletic, mobile quarterback, because I expect he's probably going to tear us up. We'll see if Gary Patterson can do us a solid and overthink it all and try and do some sort of swapping back and forth between him and Delton to kill both of their momentums. But yeah, I'm expecting a lot of yards out of this defense. I saw a lot of TCU fans online today just being extremely negative about the direction that this offense is going, that they're not able to maintain any consistency and that they're easily shut down by a lot of defenses. And the first thing I thought of was Todd Orlando, just like he's in Holes, the movie, and just saying, "Don't worry, I can fix that."
That's an old meme.
It's an old meme, but it checks out. The thing that would have given me hope is if this game was immediately after Oklahoma State, I would have felt really good about our defense's chances. I don't think there's a lot of concern with Alex Delton or Max Duggan yet, as far as their arms are concerned. So even though they have a guy who is undoubtedly one of the best receivers in terms of just his physical ability in Jalen Reagor, they just don't have a quarterback who can consistently deliver the ball to him and really turn him into a weapon. So it would have been a lot like the Oklahoma State offense and a lot like the game plan that we had there. I would have said our focus should be on shutting down Anderson and Alanalua and double up Rhaegor, and then just whatever else happens, you're fine with, because you're just not going to let those guys beat you. But due to the struggles that we've had these last 3 weeks defensively, I don't feel like that's nearly going to be as easy to execute as it sounds.
Yeah, I think early on in the year, you probably feel a little confident, but now that Texas has been exposed, no, not so much. So with that, it's probably worth talking about the best matchup in this game, and that's going to be the Texas offense versus the TCU defense. I'm not saying that the TCU defense is elite, but there's some good parts there, right? There's enough ingredients in the salad to make you go, that might be good. The biggest being, at least in my opinion, Jeff Gladney, who is the best corner in the Big 12 right now. Potential first or second round pick kind of guy, good. And he's likely going to be on the outside. And, you know, a lot of teams are just refusing to throw his way, and it almost hasn't mattered because he still find a way to make plays around the ball. So he might just be on Colin Johnson. We might just get another quiet game from Colin Johnson, but it's okay because the rest of the TCU defense, there's some good parts and then there's some other not so good parts.
Yeah, great defense has kind of been the calling card for Gary Patterson his entire career at TCU. And this year, while it's not as good as it usually is, it's not some abysmal level of defense like we've seen from our guys this year. They're still solid, still a lot of good guys. There are issues, from what I understand, talking with TCU fans. There's a lot of issues with being able to create a pass rush without having to blitz, which sounds very familiar. But I think the biggest thing, my player that's most important for the TCU defense is going to be defensive tackle Ross Blacklock. He leads TCU already as it is in sacks with 3.5 sacks on the year. And I think we're at that point where our offensive line, after a quick start to the year, seems to have been exposed by Oklahoma. Even Kansas was able to victimize the offensive line. But we saw what a really strong NFL caliber defensive tackle can do to the interior of our line, especially on the right side. So I would not at all be surprised to see Blacklock absolutely drinking Junior Angelo's milkshake again, much like Stills did to him during the West Virginia game.
Yeah, sounds about right. You know, the positive parts are that TCU's defense at every level of the defense has one guy who's very good, surrounded by not so good guys, maybe meh. Like the defensive line has Ross Blacklock and then a bunch of defensive ends who are kind of just okay. At linebacker, they have Garrett Wallow, and then a bunch of guys are just kind of okay, and they're just kind of shuffling through replacements now. And then defensive back, same thing, Jeff Gladney, and then a bunch of guys are just so-so in there. So there's definitely avenues to attack. There's definitely guys you can match up against and try to exploit, but that's just the TCU defense right now.
Yeah, and luckily, like you said, that with it being an interesting matchup and with our offense being the way it is, with our wide receiver core being the way it is, it's another situation. I've said it for the past few weeks, and it feels like Sam just ignores me every time I say it. Despite the fact that they have a good cover corner, we are not in any situation where we need to challenge that corner. If he's covering Colin Johnson, Brennan Eagles, Jake Smith, Devin Duvernay, those guys will do fine. Hell, we've even got Cade Brewer more involved over the past few weeks in the passing game. So there's no reason to attack him if we don't have to. And I feel like with this wide receiver core, there is no reason for us to do it because it's not like we can't make plays without Colin Johnson distracting him.
Yeah, basically. So with that, I think we're going to jump into the all name team candidates for TCU. The first one is tight end Pro Wells.
Next up, we got running back Siwo Alanalua. He is that number two running back, so you'll see his name pop up plenty.
Josh, I believe it's Shewo. There's a silent H in there. Shewo.
I think that's the opposite of a silent H. There is no H in the name, and you just told me that I need to pronounce one. is the complete opposite of a silent H.
You know, I've heard it Shewo on the broadcast, so I just figured there was an H. My bad.
No, it is S-E-W-O. So.
Oh, man. Okay. But yeah, it's pronounced Shewo.
Shewo on Lanalua. There you go.
Yeah. All right.
Can't even pronounce it right then.
Ah, fine. Okay, so you messed up the pronunciation and I messed up the spelling. Together, we got everything right, though. That's what counts, right?
Or together, we got everything wrong.
Okay, I'm not a glass half empty guy, okay? I'm not talking about the Texas defense
here. We literally spent
like
40 minutes of this podcast being very glass half empty. Don't you lie to me, Tux.
Okay, well, fine, whatever. All right.
Just read the next name, okay?
All right, fine. Jesus. The next is TCU wide receiver Tavalence Hunt, and there's an apostrophe after the T. So it's T apostrophe Valence.
Next up is running back Amari Demarcado. I think he might be the fourth string running back, so there's a chance we could see some light touches from him, but I wouldn't count on his name popping up too much.
All right, and then we have another one, a wide receiver named Trevante Heights.
Then we got one of those good safeties for TCU, or good, sort of the as a relative term. One of the guys on the secondary for him. But Ardarius Washington, I believe he actually technically leads them in picks. So that is definitely a name to keep an eye on for more reasons than just entertainment.
Yeah, and then we have another safety named LaKendrick Van Zandt.
This is overall just a strong secondary because we've also got safety Atanza Vongor, who was extremely popular among Texas fans. Going through recruiting, that name popped up a lot during Texas recruiting efforts. I distinctly remember his recruitment because of the name.
Yeah, exactly. It just sticks with you. And then finally, we have another defensive back, cornerback Travius Hodges Tomlinson.
Yeah, he's got everything in there. He's got the apostrophe. He's got a hyphen in the name. He's got that. Yeah, that basically the two-part first name. Always a good formula for success. With that, let's move into those predictions and those hot takes. Tux, you are the one who is not usually here, so I'll let you go first. What is your score prediction? I believe, as of recording right now, we opened with TCU as a 2.5-point favorite. I believe the line has swung to Texas being a 1-point favorite with an over-under sitting right about 60, I think 59.5, according to what I saw. So with that, what's your call?
I do think that Max Duggan will probably have a turnover or two. After all, he is a first-year starter, but surprisingly, he has not had any picks so far this year. So he's incredibly safe. He just, you know, doesn't inspire much confidence in the passing game. But on the other hand, our defense is so terrible. So terrible to watch. If Texas is to win it, they'll have to win it on offense. But I just don't have the confidence. And this is one of those moments where I'll believe Texas winning at TCU after I see it. And also, I've been horrendously wrong on this podcast, so I'm just going to keep doing that. I'm going to pick TCU to win 41-31 and hope that I'm wrong again.
It would really hurt to have another offense that has struggled as much as TCU's and Kansas's did before they played us, to have both of those teams put up 40 on us, or 40 plus on us. So let's hope it doesn't come to that. For that reason, I'm going 38-30 Texas. Because I am a homer, I'm not going to pretend like I'm trying to be objective here. I'm still rooting for Texas. I would like to see us put in a decent game, hoping to see less turnovers, better ball security from guys like Jake Smith, better decision making from Sam Ellinger, not like that interception he threw against Kansas where he just didn't see the guy covering Colin Johnson. So I think that'll really be the key for us, is to make those good decisions with the ball. I do expect TCU is going to still get their yards. They're still going to get a lot of points. So they'll hit that 30. But my hot take, which I think might be the spiciest take I've done so far, just based on how this season has gone, I'm going to say that no Texas starter sustains an injury that keeps them out for more than a snap.
Spicy.
Yeah, it's almost impossible. It sounds crazy when you sort of read it off like that. It sounds like an idiotic thing to think. Any other year, it'd be like, okay, your hot take is that no one is going to get hurt. But this year, it just feels like someone has always been cursed on this team. So this is the one where we don't have anyone miss more than a stinger or something. Well, that does it for this episode. Thanks to everyone for listening along with us. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at the FTH Podcast for more spicy takes on Texas-related news. Also, be sure to follow Hornscast on the podcast network of your choice, as well as on Twitter, to keep up with all our new episodes, as well as the other shows on the network in BC Unplugged, 4th and 5. And I believe the first episode of Pretend We're Football will be up, talking about the basketball team, before this episode goes live. So be sure to check that out. Thank you again to our sponsor today in laststandhats.com. And remember to use the promo code HORNSCAST10 to save some money on your purchase. We will see you next week to discuss what will hopefully be a much less frustrating result than what we've had the last 2 weeks. But until next time, hook 'em.
Hook 'em.